Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Literature, and today I'm here with Jennifer Lang, who is the author of Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature. Jennifer, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
Could you start by talking a little bit about how this memoir came to be and together and why you decided to write it?
Sure. I tend to have really long answers, which is why I think I write, so that I can, condense and compress. Because if I'm left to just speak, it's like everything comes out. I will try and answer concisely. I was in the middle of my MFA at Vermont College of Fine Arts, writing an essay about being in my early 20s, mid-20s, newly married, living in Israel unexpectedly, married to a Frenchman, and the first air raid siren of my life, and running for shelter, and the first night of the first Gulf War. And I wrote this essay about being in the sealed room, which is what it was called, with my husband. And my mentor started writing to me comments. I think you should separate your marriage from the sealed room. And I spent months in the margin saying, why, what? And him saying, I think your marriage deserves it more space and its own space. I think your marriage is interesting. And so it started from there. And that was in 2015. So a long time ago. It's been a long journey.
So did you write these with the idea that you were going to put together a collection, put together a book, or were you just kind of writing I don't know if piecemeal is the right word to say, but were you writing this with that end vision in mind?
So I would say that I, for years, starting graduate school, I was writing around and around and around many of the themes in the book, one of which is home, feeling other, home, belonging, longing, identity. And with this mentor's explicit comment to give thought to writing, giving more space to my marriage and my writing, I then asked my husband at the time if he gave me permission. And I started writing a new document, a new file. I called it Scenes from a Mixed Marriage. And, big difference 2015 to 2023, it went from a document that was rough and my husband hadn't looked at it at all, no interest, to a book. There's a big leap there. And so, he wasn't thrilled at first. I'd say now he's really proud, but he wasn't thrilled. He's kind of the main character.
And he comes through this very much. So he is he's at somewhat peace with it now, then it sounds like.
I'd say he's at peace and he's proud. I mean, so it's good for me when I go to the States and have book events because he's not with me. So I can really read whatever I want from the book and not be embarrassed. I just had my first big event in Tel Aviv on Thursday night with my husband, my 30-year-old firstborn, his wife, and my 24-year-old thirdborn in the front row. And that will never happen again. And I had to look above them and to the right of them. I could not look at them and take the whole event seriously. So, it's tough. It's tough being the spouse of and the child of a memoir writer.
Yes, especially when you're writing about like your life and your decisions with them, you start like with this. One thing I really like is that you play a little bit throughout with a sort of genre. You have some sort of call and response in it, but you start with this like the for my first 18 years and give us a bit of a map. And so, can you talk, because that was actually really helpful in reading, right? Can you talk about a little bit about this kind of playing around with, like, you know, using the map, using some of the sort of call and response or listings that you do and that kind of thing, and the genre that you played with in this?
I adore this question because it's become the thing that I have loved I loved the most about the process. So in the ninth hour during submitting what is now my second book coming out in October called Landed, A Yogi's Memoir in Pieces and Poses, I started to see, actually, I'm sorry, let me backtrack. During the submission process for this manuscript, Places We Left Behind, I started to notice the expression, we're open to experimental prose. And I fell down a rabbit hole, and I love the rabbit hole I fell through. So I first went and recalled an earlier reader of an earlier different manuscript saying, I wish I could see the pro-con list about you moving in with your boyfriend, now husband. And I thought to myself 30-something years later, well, I can easily recreate that pro-con list. It, you know, it feels really clear in my head. So the playing with form, what I call experimental, playful part of the manuscript, came really late in the game, midway through the submission process. And when I got a yes, and we like what you're doing, I went into the whole document again, and I did as much as I could because I realized I was onto something. So I do a bunch of things. What you're calling a map, I think you just called the first. So I called a flow chart for lack of like knowing what to call it. Everything I did in the manuscript, I taught myself. Well, YouTube taught me. YouTube tutorials taught me. Google. I Googled and then got to YouTube, and then YouTube taught me how to do it with Word. I didn't have a designer. I worked with Word. I think that's considered a flow chart technically. I knew that our vitals, me, American born, he, French born, we married in Israel. We stayed for 5 years. We had a baby. We left. We left for Paris. We were there for a year. We left for California. We were there for 6 years. Our two girls were born there. We left. We moved to New York. We were there for 6 years. We left with our three kids. We came to Israel for a year. We went back to New York for 3 years. We returned to Israel. No one could keep our story straight. And I needed a map. Okay, so now I'm calling it a map. I needed a timeline. I needed a timeline. And those nine boxes show not just me and my marriage, but what triggered me to have this wanderlust, which was my junior year abroad in Paris. My mom, I warned you, I talked a lot. Sorry. My mom put me in a French class when I was six, a pilot program in our community, French or Spanish. She chose French. And I stayed almost my entire childhood academic career. I think I quit in fourth and fifth grade. I wanted to walk to school with my best friend. I didn't want to go to French class before school. The French teacher, Madame Maker, came to the house begging me to promise that I would start up again middle school. And I was such a good Jewish girl. I said yes. And I did it in middle school. I did it all through high school. I did freshman, sophomore year of college. I did my junior year abroad in Paris. And there I had really a life-changing event happen for me. It's not life-changing probably for anyone else on my program. We were 120 students. And ironically, and I'm going to look up the dates, it was January of 1986. So the first air raid siren of my life was January 18th of 1991. But 5 years earlier, I was a student in the 17th arrondissement staying with a French family, extreme right-wing Le Pen voting family. Le Pen, not Marie, but her father. And the Challenger exploded, and the French kids in my family summoned me down the hall of the apartment to come and watch. I stood in the doorway of their parents' bedroom where the only TV set was, watching the Challenger explode. And it was this really huge moment, and I get teary. where I heard the American broadcasters in the background in English, but I also heard the French dubbing it because they dub the present tense, they dub everything in the foreground. And the two languages were just in my ears, like, and I had full comprehension for the first time of the French. I'd spent the first few months mute because it was so fast. And I realized in that moment that I understood completely. And I had this moment of, oh my God, I have mastery of this language and I love this country and culture. Where do I, maybe I don't go back to California as a young adult after college. Maybe I don't live in America after college. Maybe I live in Europe. Maybe I stay in France. Like, it just opened up this whole thing to me of, wow, where would I, what is home and where do I belong? Because I really love this place. And so it really starts from there, this kind of searching for where to live.
Right. And so your memoir really takes place. It's very much not today, right? It's not present day. And so can you talk a bit about that experience and sort of writing about 20, 30 or so years ago and sort of gathering doing your research and sort of gathering this and putting this together, something that you sort of have to go back to and weren't originally thinking about, it sounds like, going back to until you were pushed to do so.
First of all, I forgot to say, and so the experimentation that I did, sorry, if I can just backtrack for a moment. I use strike throughs. I do checklists. I zigzag on the page. Some of it is to mirror the text. Some of it is to avoid repetition, which I can't stand in reading a book. I love reading a good novel, but I can't stand when an author repeats information for the reader over and over. And so I use symbols, icons, and graphics to say things because I don't need to repeat what I'm trying to say. The reader gets it and I know it. And because it was fun. And in it, the experimentation actually kind of globally mirrors my marriage. So my marriage is very playful, very flirtatious from the beginning. It doesn't mean we didn't go through really hard stuff. This book is very, very hard, in fact. But that overall mirror playfulness adds a lightness to the difficult story. So that's the experimentation part. Okay, so this question, I'm trying to remember it. Yes, I did a lot of research. I went back to our old photo albums, starting from when we met, when we were 1989, 23 years old. I had journals, not consistently, but I had a lot from my 20s into my 30s and 40s. I wrote off and on. But what I really had, which was extraordinary, my mom, my aunt, and a very close friend had returned my letters that I had written to them in the late 80s into the mid 2000s. And that was amazing. And that's where I got to reacquainted with my younger self. And those letters helped me see that I had had my own separate love affair with Israel before meeting my husband. I spent decades pointing a finger. People would say, why are you moving to Israel? And I would point a finger at him and say, because of him. But in fact, I had my own questioning if I belonged here. And I'd forgotten. So those letters were huge. And they made me go back into the manuscript to reframe the narrative.
I love that they saved the letters. That's awesome. And having those. So let's talk a little bit, because you sort of meet your husband and then you kind of negotiate where you're going to live. It seems like, and it's not like a one and done negotiation throughout this memoir, you are negotiating where you're going to live. And so can you talk about that a little bit and what that was like or is like, and just sort of starting out a sort of marriage and a life with someone, and then also like having to pick up and move multiple times and negotiate that.
So I think when we first got married, there was no talk of leaving. It was really, I felt like I married Israel as much as I married this man. And I just had to accept that. And It wasn't until after I finished 2 years into our two to three years into our marriage, I finished a master's in Israel at University of Haifa and a thesis, that my husband saw what my MA experience was like, and I don't think he wanted anything to do with it. Sometimes the professors were called up for reserve duty, so there wasn't class, or there were protests on campus. Like in Haifa, there's a huge Arab contingency, and there'd be like protests, and we couldn't get to campus, and so school wasn't happening. And he was just like, I don't want this. And so he wanted to do an MBA. He had studied chemical engineering, and after 5 years of studying that and becoming a chemical engineer and working as one, he was disenchanted, just not wanting to do it. And computers were like the thing. It was in the by this point, it was like mid-90s, and there was one computer in the lab where he worked for the Israel Electric Corporation, and he was just dying to be on it. And his boss, a pure chemical engineer, was just resentful, didn't want him doing it. And so my husband knew he had to get out. And he felt like the way to get out was through an MBA, and that he didn't want to do it in Israel. And so we left. So we left, and we ended up in Paris for a year, where I worked, and I had already lived there and worked after college. So it was kind of, I don't know if the word is easy, but I was really eager to leave Israel. So it worked well for me. Our son was he had a babysitter, and my husband was in school. But I said, if we're going to pack up and leave our life, then I would like a year near my parents in California. So that's where the negotiation started, way back. Very dangerous, marital, manipulative negotiations. I think it's my first time in all of these conversations I've had where I have to say, you know what? It was probably me like saying, if we're going to do this, then I want, you know, I want my way also. So I'm going to start the negotiations.
And so what was that like, sort of thinking about this? And some of it seems really exhausting.
Yeah.
Right. Like moving back and forth and back and forth. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what it was, because this is sort of all about sort of place and family, and you are uprooting and moving and sort of having to ground yourself. And in the book, it sort of ends when you return to Israel, right? But throughout it, you're moving back and forth. So can you talk a little bit about that and that experience of having children, having to sort of move not just down the street, but like across the halfway around the world at some points?
Yeah. Draining. Really draining, emotionally and physically. We were just kind of, we were young when we got married. We were 25. It turns out this is very present tense. We are both really strong, what's the word? Strong-headed, really opinionated, really stubborn, really strong-headed. We each wanted to have our own way. I don't think he was used to, you know, bossy, American, bold wife character in his life, you know, pushing back, which is definitely what I did. And I think I always knew. So we went to California for a year, and it turned into 6. And then he got told by his company either he had to move to Israel or to New York. And I said, this was winter of 2001. And I said, New York, Israel isn't safe. So if you think about the timing, right? By the time we moved, it was late June 2001. We didn't move to the city. We moved to Westchester, to White Plains. We were like 40 minutes north of the city. And it was exhausting at every turn. And at the same time, I would say everywhere we lived, so Paris, Northern California, White Plains, I always knew it wasn't long term. We didn't talk about it, but it just always felt like we had one foot out the door, or he had one foot out the door. I guess it's that. I didn't, he did, which meant by how whatever that is in math, it meant that I did too, right? I felt just floating.
And one of the things you kind of talk about in here, and you mentioned sort of New York and the time you moved to New York, but one of the things was that you didn't want to be in Israel because you were concerned about sort of violence, you're concerned about the instability, and you're now living in Israel and you've been living in Israel for
12 years
now. So can you talk a bit about that, writing that you started to write this, like you said, well before what's happening right now in Israel, and you've been there for a while. So can you talk about what it's like right now to live in Israel, to sort of write about this, and how that kind of navigating all that space?
I think before I get to that, I have to go back to, so we moved to New York, to the suburbs in late June of 2001, and my husband was in the city on September 11th working, and he called me from the rooftop of his office building, which was Midtown, like Macy's area, watching the second tower, and basically said to me, see, terrorism is everywhere. Even New York isn't safe. And what happened that day is, like, I lost my argument for forever, really, because nowhere is safe. Now we know, right? We've grown up. We know. And the world has changed. So here we are in a world of what we call in Israel post-October 7th. The book launched. It was released on September 5th. I was in America, in California, on October 7th. And my husband was here, our 30-year-old son and his wife. My one middle daughter lives in Brooklyn. My youngest was actually in Asia. She was learning Vietnamese, and so she was there. So we were very much, like our family is, we're often divided and spread out across different places. And so it wasn't surprising we weren't all here. I'm thankful that my middle daughter, who lives in Brooklyn, was with me in California. We were together. We really got through it together. I mean, got through it. It's not past tense. And I changed my entire reason for being in America to promote my book. The whole conversation, every conversation I went to have about marriage and voice and identity and home, I changed. I changed to what I call solidarity events. And not everyone was Jewish who came to my events. And I moved from the West Coast to White Plains, Westchester, New York, and I was in the city also for an event. And I started to talk with people. We'd go around the room and say who we were and if we had any connection to Israel, if we'd ever been to Israel, what our connection was if we had one, and just talk, because I needed it. I needed to be held. And I did a lot of crying. A lot of people did. And I flew back here October 31st. And upon landing, it took me about 3 weeks to close an incredible emotional gap between me, my immediate family who'd been here, and everyone else who'd been here the whole time, because I was petrified. I was petrified to walk outside. I was petrified to be home alone. I mean, and that's not normally like that at all here. I was this is going to sound horrible, on the drive home from the airport. It's like a 20-minute drive. We actually had a siren. We stopped under an overpass. I opened the door. We were behind other people on the highway, all stopped, and I opened the door to get out and to run, to do what I was seeing people do, to get over the guardrail, to crouch. And my husband said, you should stay here. It's safer than there because we're under an overpass. Trust me. And I felt like, I don't trust you, dude. I don't trust you. I don't trust anybody. The next day or 4 days later, I had a doctor's appointment, and I didn't want to walk by myself 20 minutes, and I didn't want to ride a bus by myself. And I made my husband come with me. I mean, irrational. I'm 58 years old. Irrational fear. So I'm happy to say that by late November, the fears were gone. But with those fears being gone, I also will say to you, I've had an incredible emotional shift myself. I came back to the country in 2011, still really not whole being here, not completely at peace. And the second book that's coming out in October is my 7-year journey that followed making peace with this place. But I will fast forward in time. So 2011 to November of 2023, and I will say to you, my entire lens has shifted, and I now feel like I can't live anywhere else. I don't feel welcome, because even if I don't sound Israeli, I'm Israeli and I'm Jewish, and it's a huge part of my identity when all is said and done. I don't necessarily look it. I don't necessarily act it. I don't necessarily sound it, but it is who I am. And it's my birthright. Eastern European grandparents, my grandfather, my Zeta, fled the Tsar, the anti-Semitic Tsar of Russia in the 19-teens, fleeing to San Francisco, where he had an older sibling. 10 years later, 12 years later, my grandmother arrived from Romania, both of them illiterate, uneducated, penniless. And they ended up as like the movers and shakers of the San Francisco Jewish community in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. They greeted every Israeli dignitary, from Golda Meir to David Ben-Gurion, every Israeli dignitary passing through San Francisco. He was in the Yiddish theater. They were part of all of the, they founded their synagogue, Congregation Beth Shalom. Like, it's my history. So that's my story.
So, well, thank you for sharing that, right? And as you're talking and through your book, one thing that comes up that, as I'm excited to hear about your sort of next book, but is yoga, right? And how yoga became a home for you, right? And so can you talk a bit about that and a bit about sort of your journey with yoga and your experience and how and why that became important to talk about throughout even this book about your relationship, right? About your moving and your relationship of place.
Another one of my favorite questions. Somebody way on an early conversation said, it's almost like yoga is a character in the book. I'm like, yeah, that's neat. So the word I used before about how I felt with all the moving, the packing, the rooting and uprooting was floating. And yoga, I stepped on my first yoga mat in 1995. I was newly like 30 years old in a day or 2 days. And I went to this class with what ended up being like a super famous yoga instructor named Rodney Lee, like nationally known in America, maybe internationally, I'm not sure. 50 people, Wednesday morning, mat to mat, inches, 1 inch between our mats, Wednesday for 2 hours. In the morning of a workday in San Francisco, Oakland, California, in the beginning of like what led to the dot-com boom. And every one of us called ourselves consultant. We all worked from home, but the word was consultant. Because I would just go to this class and think like, how can all these people be off from 9 to 11 in the morning? Men and women. And yoga, What lured me back to the mat week after week, Wednesday after Wednesday, wasn't the physical. It wasn't the poses. It was the language. Rodney's language in particular, all about rooting down into the ground and reaching upward and anchoring our feet and feeling our feet on the floor and digging our souls into the earth. And I would weep. Because I felt the opposite. I felt floating. I felt untethered after a number of moves already. And I went back week after week for his words. And that mat really became like a home for me. It's not past tense. I mean, yeah. And I can still weep on a mat.
Yes, and you like do this lovely yoga is a character, right? You mix in some of like how your yoga experiences and how yoga has changed for you, and your experience with yoga has changed with your experience with your relationship, with your marriage, and how that sort of has changed throughout time and throughout the spaces you're moving to. So, as a person who does yoga and actually does love my corpse posts. There were certain things where I laughed. I was like, oh, my yoga teacher would love this.
To please think... have her read the book.
There are certain things. And then when you got to the, like, we do this, she does a stretchless yoga, right? And so it's just like low impact. We do not get off the ground kind of stretch, which is wonderful. And it made me think towards the end when you were talking about how you love to do the fast paced sort of flow, but you are not doing that. So I'm like, yep,
Yeah.
That's where we're at. So could you, we've been talking about this for a while, but can you maybe read from this for us so that people can get an idea of sort of what you're writing about and what you're...
With pleasure. I think the one thing that we haven't touched on, which will come up right here. So we didn't just have, my husband and I didn't just have one major issue between us, where to live. The other major issue was how Jewish to be. So it's our shared religion, but it turns out that that shared religion, there's so many ways to be that way. And I grew up in a very assimilated, I always say the only time God was ever used in my home or mentioned was when my mom would drop something in the kitchen and she would scream, God damn it, like where the whole house would hear. And otherwise, we didn't talk about God. There was no, it wasn't belief-based. It was inconsistent. It was tradition. It was family. It was culture and family more than anything. And Philippe grew up tradition, more attached to the laws of Judaism. And those laws, they are, I say this as a Jew, they are like for me, a noose around my neck. Like they're just too technical, specific, and restrictive. So those were the differences between us. First chapter. Well, chapter two, conjunctions. And I call them chapterettes because they're tiny. After making love on his mismatched sheets, Philippe and I tally how many times we've each been to Israel. I count my trips. 1971, 1975, 1981, 1983, 1984, 1985, 1988, and now, in 1989, needing both hands. He counts his on one hand. Three. You win, he says, as if we're competing. I scan his room. No posters, no mirror, no nightstand. So boyish and beautiful, especially his bed. Tell me everything, he says, adorning me with butterfly-like kisses. My tendency to share too much too soon makes me hesitate. He already knows that I'm here despite the first intifada or Palestinian uprising, between a job in France and graduate school in New York, to immerse in Hebrew as well as to spend time with my only sibling and extended family, and that I miss my open-minded, California-born parents in the San Francisco Bay Area. But he has no idea that I made a Jackson Pollock mess of my love life the past 2 years and promised my mother that I wouldn't fall in love and stay. No, wait. I want to know why you're here, I say, running my fingers through his silky chestnut hair. What made you immigrate? Israeli chutzpah, Haifa, the Mediterranean, the beach, body surfing, falafel, spicy food. Plus, my brother plans to make Aliyah, too. We each have one sibling. Mine immigrated to Jerusalem, my temporary home base, immediately after college a few years earlier. And since Aliyah comes from the verb la'alot, which means to go up, Philippe says, I went up in my Jewish observance. Tu comprends? Do I understand that he changed his lifestyle for a country? Absolutely not. All weekend, I study this man, admiring how his pointy nose dominates an angular face, his olive skin glistens with oily patches, and his feet have white lines underneath his sandal straps. All weekend, he reaches for me, emeritus and solicitous of my attention. Ever since we met at a Shabbat retreat for Francophones 144 hours earlier, I haven't stopped thinking about him, convinced my secular mother will tell me it was Beshert, Yiddish for destiny, after enrolling me in a pilot French program when I was six. Philippe fits every box on my imaginary list. French, check. Jewish, check. Smart, check. Single, check. Sexy with a guarded smile, check. A far cry from the men of late. One Catholic Parisian whom Sib refused to acknowledge. One Russian married man whom my parents refused to discuss. One once upon a time college friend who refused to commit. Burrowed in Philippe's biceps, I try to block out the conjunctions. If he wasn't Sabbath observant, and he wasn't enwrapped with his new homeland, but he is.
Thank you for reading that. I have to ask you, because you said it, right, the chapterettes, all of these are really sort of short, a page, 2 pages, right? So What was that like? Did you go into this knowing you were going to write these really short chapterettes, as you say, or and how was that having to think about how do I sort of paint this image, this picture, this sort of part of my life in these, you know, what, 500 words or so?
Yeah. No, Rebecca, no. I had a 95-something-thousand word manuscript by the end of graduate school. And it was, the way I describe it is, long-winded, overwritten, boring, and flat. And after hiring a developmental editor, because I couldn't see through the words, and I had no idea what I was trying to say, one of the main things that she highly stressed upon me was, put this away for a while. And I did. And it was during the putting away, which was months long, that I took a class online, how to write flash. And normally we think of flash as flash fiction. In my world, it's flash nonfiction. And it changed my world completely. So around the same time, I hopped on board as an assistant editor at Brevity Journal, which is flash nonfiction, 750 words max stories. I was writing in the class, I think the longest we wrote was 500 words. We were under 300 words and 200 words and 100 words and put it away in 6 months, take it out and cut it in half. And I realized not long ago during a conversation that in fact, it's where my writing career started. I worked in the late 90s. I hopped on board of a website company, new website company in San Francisco when we were living in the East Bay, the Bay Area, as a copy editor and then writer for a website company called babycenter.com while I was pregnant and having children and, you know, doing all of that early adulthood stuff or middle adulthood stuff. And I yearned to see my name in print, and I got the name of an editor at Parenting Magazine. And Parenting, the editor hired me. They used to have, I don't know if they still do, these little columns in the back that were by age range. And it was 200 words and 250 words and 300 words. And I don't even know if I ever wrote more than 300 words. So I learned, in fact, how to write concisely way back early in my writing career, but I'd forgotten, of course. So, and I think it just rocks. It rocked my prose. When I write long, I'm lost. I have no idea what the heart of the story is. I just know I need to say it.
So along those lines, like, I'm going to ask you my like final question because it kind of fits in with what you read and what we've been talking about. So this book is out now. And so, and you've mentioned a little bit of that you have another one coming out. So your last final kind of promotions, what's going on? What are you writing about? What do people need to know?
So you can find Places We Left Behind at bookshop.org, barnesandnoble.com, Amazon, of course, and on the publisher, vineleavespress.com. I run israelwriterstudio.com, where I teach creative writing classes in English in Israel and sometimes online. And on October 15th, I get a second go at trying to promote a book, and I'm hoping that the world will not crash and burn between now and then or right after it comes out. It already feels crashing and burning to me, but I will birth my second book called Landed, A Yogi's Memoir in Pieces and Poses. It's a pretty ambitious structure. I hope it works. It's my seven-year search on and off a yoga mat or my seven-year journey on and off a yoga mat to make peace with this place being my home, because it's not a given.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for talking with me for New Books Network. Again, Jennifer Ling, the author of Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature.
Thank you, Rebecca, so much.